Welcome to episode 18 of the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast. I'm your host, Alan Wolin. Before we dive into today's topic, I'd like to tell you about three ways you can support the show. Number one, rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts. This costs no money, and it really helps because the more ratings and reviews we get, the more we show up in search engines so new people can find us. Number two, purchase and post our Thomas Sowell Post-it notes. Each pad costs $3, including shipping and handling, and features 50 different Sowell quotes. I'll explain later in the show why these Post-it notes are so vital to the mission of the show, and I'll play an amazing clip from Steve Jobs, which helps to make this point. Number three, I started a Patreon page for people who want to simply donate money to help support the show. 100% of the money received will go toward promoting the mission of the show, which is to disseminate and promote the ideas and works of Thomas Sowell. It's that simple. You can find our Patreon at patreon.com/Sowell Genius. Now, I want to say this. A lot of podcasters try to find ways to incentivize donors to give at higher levels by offering benefits to those who do, like early access to episodes, bonus episodes, live Zoom calls, and if you give enough, they will even attend your daughter's Sweet 16 party. I'm not doing any of that. There will be no VIP Zoom calls and no secret episodes, because I believe that access to the teachings of Thomas Sowell is a basic human right and must be provided free of charge to anyone willing to receive them. So if you want to support the show financially, do it for one reason only, because you can afford to, and because you believe that if more people know about Sowell and his ideas, the world will be a better place. No nonsense, no bells and whistles, no smoke and mirrors. In later episodes, I will tell you where I plan to spend the money. Once again, patreon.com/Sowell Genius. In this episode, we turn our attention to Chapter 6 of Thomas Sowell's 1993 book, Inside American Education. Sowell named the chapter New Racism and Old Dogmatism, and his focus there was to analyze the real-world effects of affirmative action policies which began in America in the late 1960s. Sowell makes a very surprising and counterintuitive argument in this chapter, namely, that affirmative action policies, also called preferential admissions policies, don't actually benefit the people they are intended to help. Sowell makes the claim that these policies not only harm their intended beneficiaries, but that they also set in motion a series of incentives and constraints which harm the university system as well as society in general. I'm going to split this discussion into three sections. In part one, I will present Sowell's main arguments about the real-world effects of affirmative action policies. In part two, I visit an elite college campus here in Los Angeles to speak with current students about affirmative action and to get their opinions on how such policies are going. In part three, I will play clips from other Sowell books, interviews with Sowell himself, as well as podcast excerpts from three other amazing scholars who discuss affirmative action, and I'll offer you my commentary on what they have to say. So let's begin. Sowell starts the discussion of affirmative action policies by making the distinction between the goals of such programs and their actual real-world effects. This is an important distinction and one which you will find in almost every Sowell book. Namely, every program, every policy, and every cause has its goals and its well-meaning intentions, which may look good on paper, but what actually happens in the real world with real flesh and blood people may be wholly different and even the opposite of what was originally intended. According to Sowell, affirmative action policies have four main goals. Goal number one is to increase the numbers of racial minorities going to college. Goal number two is to benefit the racial groups from which those students come by having more of their members obtain advanced degrees. Goal number three is to benefit the colleges themselves by increasing racial diversity on campus. And goal number four is to benefit American society as a whole by making it fairer and more equitable in general. Sowell then dives right in and says what he thinks the actual real-world effects of affirmative action policies are, and he names six. Effect number one, a dramatic mismatching of students with colleges. Effect number two, lower graduation rates among minority students. Effect number three, insecurity and imposter syndrome effects among minority students. Effect number four, a pitting of black students against white students. Effect number five, increased resentment among white students. And effect number six, a shifting of majors among minority students and a diverted focus toward political activism over attaining traditional educational goals. Let's start with the so-called mismatching effect, which Sowell spends considerable time discussing in the book. Sowell draws inspiration from Professor Clyde Summers of the Yale Law School, who, in the 1960s, was one of the first scholars to warn of the mismatching which would occur in the wake of preferential admissions policies. So what is mismatching and how does it unfold? Let me explain the idea this way. Imagine if you were to rank all American colleges on a large spreadsheet based on the intellectual standards required to be admitted to each one. And let's assume that you use some standardized measurement of intellectual ability to make the rankings more objective. One could use IQ tests, SAT, or ACT exams, or some other scientific test of intellectual ability. At the top of the spreadsheet might be the Ivy League schools and other top-tier colleges. At the bottom of the list might be some community colleges and other easier-to-get-into schools. And the vast majority of schools would lie somewhere in between. Now let's assume that you divide all those schools into 10 equally sized tiers. So the colleges with the highest standards would be in tier number 1, and the colleges with the lowest standards would be in tier number 10. Now keep in mind that I am not at all referring to the quality of the education you might receive in one tier or another. We are not saying that the education you will get in a tier 1 school will be better than that of a tier 10 school. We are simply referring to the objective intellectual and academic standards required to get you into the different tiers. The way affirmative action works is that students who would ordinarily qualify for no higher than a particular tier get boosted or bumped into a higher tier than their test scores would usually warrant. So for example, a student whose test scores might qualify them for a tier 2 school would get bumped up into a tier 1 school instead. Or a student who might usually qualify for a tier 3 school gets boosted into a tier 2 school instead. It's also possible for someone who would usually qualify for a tier 7 school to get bumped up 6 levels to a tier 1 school. In a way, it's like that old game of chutes and ladders we used to play as kids. This is what Clyde Summers of Yale Law School and Thomas Sowell call the mismatching effect. Technically, it's not just the school itself with which the student is being mismatched. The students who are getting bumped up are also being mismatched with the other students attending that institution. Let me give you an analogy to drive home this point. There are certain sports I'm pretty good at. One of them is swimming. I'm a decent swimmer, but I am a lousy basketball player. I always have been. I'm just not that coordinated with the ball. My dribbling is pathetic and my shooting is even worse. But am I good enough to play in a neighborhood pickup game at the local schoolyard? Sure. I'm fairly tall, a little over 6 feet, so I'm a decent rebounder compared to the shorter guys, and I won't dribble or shoot too much, and will focus my efforts instead on passing the ball to the better players so my team has a chance to win the game. In short, I could get through a game or two without feeling too bad about myself and might even manage to have some fun. Now let's consider for a minute what would happen if I got mismatched into a higher league than the neighborhood schoolyard. As a thought experiment, let's imagine that the NBA decided, for whatever reason, that there weren't enough podcasters in the league. And to make the league more diverse, they invited me to play for the LA Lakers. Now, I would probably look pretty decent in one of those Lakers jerseys, and I'll bet I could even give a hell of a press conference. For sure, I would be the first NBA player in history to quote Thomas Sowell after a big game. So I wouldn't be mismatched with the Lakers per se, but I would definitely be massively mismatched with the other players on the team. This mismatching would be so extreme that I would literally not be able to dribble 2 or 3 feet without the ball getting stolen from me every time. I would not be able to shoot the ball without it getting smacked away. And forget about rebounding, passing the ball, or covering an opposing player. I would be a total mess. My teammates would quickly grow to hate me and would correctly feel that with me on the court, they have no chance of winning the game. Of course, this experience would be a massive blow to my self-esteem, and I would leave each practice depressed and dejected. But of course, I would never quit. I would stick around on the team as long as I could. After all, I hear the median NBA salary is $3.8 million a year. They're definitely going to have to fire me with numbers like that. This is the mismatching effect. In the NBA, it would be boosting a lower achieving player into a league with better performing players who got into the league based only on their talents, no other considerations. In academia, it's boosting a student with lower test scores into a college where all the other students got in based on higher test scores. Now, before you send me emails pointing out the flaws in this analogy, let me say I already know it's not a perfect one. Basketball is more of a team sport than college. I get it. But I feel that the analogy is good enough to enable listeners to get what the mismatching effect is in a way that it doesn't just reside in your brain, but also in your gut. I hope I've succeeded. Returning to my spreadsheet ranking of the 10 tiers of American colleges, let's take a look at what happens when minority students get bumped up from lower tiers to higher tiers. As Sowell points out, this boosting creates a shifting effect throughout the tiers. While minority students who would have ordinarily gotten into a tier 2 school now go to a tier 1 school instead, all the tier 2 schools will have to fill their designated minority seats by drawing minority students from the tier 3 schools instead. And the same shifting will happen all the way down the tiers until we finally get to the bottom tier. What will those bottom tier schools do? They will have to admit minority students that even they would have rejected before preferential policy admissions were begun. What's really interesting about this shifting effect is that even if only the tier 1 schools implemented affirmative action, the tier 2 schools would have to follow suit because their usual minority students were being pulled away from them. And once the tier 2 schools start doing it, the tier 3 schools would have to as well. And this would continue all the way down the line. The other interesting thing about this shifting effect is that it's not really increasing the total size of the pool of minority students. It's mostly just shifting them from one tier to the next. The only place the total number of minority students is really increasing is in the bottom tiers, and those tiers are being forced to admit minority students who they would usually reject. And one could even say that they are accepting people who probably shouldn't be pursuing college in the first place, and that those people might be better off in a trade school or simply going right to work. Now, why is mismatching such a problem for minority students? According to Sowell, it leads to higher rates of failure among the boosted minority students. Sowell says this:
the systematic mismatching of minority students with institutions, thereby artificially fostering failure among students with the qualifications to succeed. Given that law schools, like the rest of the academic world, have a whole hierarchy of work standards and a corresponding hierarchy of admissions standards, the issue was not whether a minority student was qualified to study law and become a lawyer, but whether his particular qualifications were likely to match or mismatch the institutional pace, level, and intensity of study under preferential admissions policies. While this issue was raised as regards law schools, the principle applies to the whole academic world.
In addition to fostering academic failure among minority students, the mismatching effect has profound psychological ramifications as well. When a student finds himself in an academic environment where most other students are above his level, this can be a blow to his self-esteem and can cause him intense anxiety. Sowell says this:
an intense anxiety and threat to the student's self-esteem are among the costs incurred whenever a student is admitted to a school whose normal standards he does not meet, even though he does meet the normal standards of other schools. This student does not get a better education because he is at a more prestigious school. On the contrary, he may well get a much worse education at such fast-paced institutions, in the sense of failing to learn things which he is perfectly capable of learning in a learning environment that proceeds at a normal pace. Such a minority student may end up confused, floundering, and unable to keep up.
Now, how will students deal with the psychic effects of having been mismatched? According to Sowell, there are several typical reactions observed. He says this:
what are the further consequences of such a situation? According to Summers, offers of remedial help or reduced course loads are further blows to the student's self-esteem and expressions of the institution's lack of confidence in him, and may be rejected for these reasons. The student's escape routes include absenteeism and an attitude of dismissal toward the standard curriculum as unnecessary and irrelevant, and a redirection of energies toward community activities.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Are you thinking about starting a podcast, launching a YouTube channel, or repurposing your old blog content? Then I have the podcast just for you. Hi, I'm Crystal Proffitt, host of the Proffitt Podcast. And as a content creator, I know firsthand what it's like to feel confused and overwhelmed with everything you could or should be doing. So join us every week as we strip down those processes and take all of that overwhelm away. We'll talk about the strategies I use to help creators start, launch, and market their content with confidence. If that sounds like something you're on board with, then click the link in the show notes and follow the Proffitt Podcast today.
Sowell also discusses the social effects of mismatching. These include, 1, negative reactions of white classmates who assume minority classmates only got in because of preferential policies. And these negative reactions will only serve to perpetuate the very ideas and prejudices preferential admissions policies were designed to combat. 2, a sense of intellectual inferiority among the black students, because they will inevitably be at or near the bottom of their classes in terms of grades. Sowell quotes Judge Macklin Fleming when he says this:
if, in a given class, the great majority of the black students are at the bottom of the class, this factor is bound to instill, unconsciously at least, some sense of intellectual superiority among the white students and some sense of intellectual inferiority among the black students. Such a pairing in the same school of the brightest white students in the country with black students of mediocre academic qualifications is social experiment with loaded dice and a stacked deck.
3, black students will be driven to seek recognition and self-expression by agitating to change the academic environment. Sowell quotes Fleming again:
demands will be made for elimination of competition, reduction in standards of performance, adoption of courses of study which do not require intensive legal analysis, and recognition for academic credit for sociological activities which have only an indirect relationship to legal training. Second, it seems probable that this group will seek personal satisfaction and public recognition by aggressive conduct, which, though ostensibly directed at external injustices and problems, will in fact be primarily motivated by the psychological needs of the members of the group to overcome feelings of inferiority caused by lack of success in their studies.
What's interesting about the history of the affirmative action discussion in America is that the debate really began among law school professors, deans, and judges. Why did it begin there? Because law schools are one of the few avenues of higher education in America which not only have objective test standards to get in, they also have objective test standards to get out. Let me explain. In order to get into law school, a college student has to not only have some minimum grade point average in his 4 years of college, he must also have a certain minimum score on the law school admission test, called the LSAT for short. After the student has finished law school, there is another set of exams, this time given by what is called the state legal bar, which the student must pass in order to be licensed to practice law in a given state. Each state has its own set of exams and its own standards for the minimum scores a student must achieve on these bar exams in order to practice law in that particular state. So there's an exam to get in, and there's an exam to get out. What makes this important is that these entrance and exit exams make it possible to empirically measure how the law school system is working and how affirmative action policies are playing out there. This empirical validation system is not in place with regular colleges. Yes, students may take an SAT or ACT test to get into college, but after that, it's anyone's guess as to what happened while in college and whether or not they learned anything. So we'll spend some time in the chapter looking at how LSAT scores correlated with both the grades obtained in law school as well as the probability of passing the bar exam. In other words, he was trying to determine if LSAT scores predict success in law school and in passing the bar exam. There has been a movement in higher education over the past few decades to get rid of all types of entrance exams, claiming that the exams are culturally biased and they offer no predictive value as to how students will perform academically later on. I've talked in previous episodes about the movement underfoot in many so-called exam high schools around the country, like Stuyvesant High School in New York City, to get rid of these exams and instead admit students on other criteria. By the way, Sowell went to Stuyvesant High School back in the day. As I was preparing this episode, an astonishing announcement came out of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology to bring back the SAT exam. The MIT Admissions Department put out the following statement.
After careful consideration, we have decided to reinstate our SAT-ACT requirement for future admission cycles. Our research shows standardized tests help us better assess the academic preparedness of all applicants and also help us identify socioeconomically disadvantaged students who lack access to advanced coursework or other enrichment opportunities that would otherwise demonstrate their readiness for MIT. We believe a requirement is more equitable and transparent than a test optional policy.
The announcement also says this.
Our ability to accurately predict student academic success at MIT is significantly improved by considering standardized testing, especially in mathematics, alongside other factors.
I'll put a link in the show notes to the original MIT announcement. What I think is really interesting and funny about this announcement is that they are obviously bringing the SAT back because it's a good predictor of future success at MIT, period. But they are framing this decision as if it's a better way to achieve true affirmative action. It's like when a brand of detergent announces its new and improved formula. The intellectual ingenuity of academics will never cease to amaze me. What's interesting about this MIT announcement is that Sowell uses MIT in Chapter 6 to powerfully illustrate with numbers how mismatching plays out. He says this.
The mismatching problem was dramatically demonstrated at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where the average black student scored in the top 10% nationwide on the mathematical portion of the Scholastic Aptitude Test, and in the bottom 10% at MIT. Nearly one-fourth of these students failed to graduate at MIT, and those who did had significantly lower grades than their classmates. Such wholly needless failures among highly qualified students was the price of MIT's having a racial representation that would enhance its image and keep hundreds of millions of federal dollars coming in, without being jeopardized by charges of discrimination based on underrepresentation statistics. As for the other students in MIT, the Wall Street Journal reported, a widespread, if rarely stated, perception that black students somehow lack what it takes to make the grade.
To summarize his views on academic mismatching, Sowell ends the section with this statement.
Having admitted minority students mismatched with the other students and with the institution's own academic standards, many colleges and universities have been surprised by results which were not only predictable, but almost inevitable. While there have been variations from campus to campus, the general pattern of these results has included minority student academic problems, social problems, and militant political activism centering on demands for special admissions, special programs, and special hiring of minority faculty. Most of the more prominent colleges and universities have not only acceded to most of these demands, but have also promoted double standards, both academic and social, for minority students.
I find it hard to believe that any intelligent person could think that admitting students who have much lower test scores than the vast majority of the other students at that institution would be anything other than problematic. To me, the way this plays out is so obvious that it's one of those experiments you can simply run in your mind without having to actually test in the real world. In addition, academic mismatching has nothing whatsoever to do with race or ethnicity. In my opinion, the same effects would be observed if schools mismatch students along any other criteria. Let's do another thought experiment right now. Let's imagine that for whatever reason, academia decided that there are too few left-handed students at the nation's top universities. Let's take a look at what percentage of the population is left-handed. Let me Google it. What percentage of the population is left-handed? Okay, so an article from the Washington Post pops up, which says this. Lefties make up about 10% of the world. Another one says, research suggests that between 10 and 12% of the world's population is left-handed. Okay, the exact number doesn't matter much for this thought experiment, so let's just go with 10% as a nice round number. Let's imagine that colleges and universities across the country lower their admission standards only for lefties so that more of them can get in. Their target number is to bring the number of lefties to 50% of the student body. That would seem fair, wouldn't it? Half the class is right-handed and half the class is left-handed. That feels fair and balanced to me. So each school admits a bunch of lefties who score lower than most everyone else at the school in both grades and standardized tests. What could go wrong? Well, we most probably would start to observe the same pattern of results with lefties, which Sowell has observed with minority students admitted under affirmative action. Lower grades, lower graduation rates, inferiority complexes, resentment among righties towards lefties, political agitation by lefties to change academic standards, and a push to admit even more left-handed students and hire more left-handed faculty. So to me, it seems obvious that affirmative action of any kind, whether it's racially or ethnically based, or whether it's based on any other imaginable criteria, whether it is applied in schools or on the basketball courts, will lead to the exact same mismatching effect and all the expected negative consequences. So if academic mismatching of minority students leads to lower performance results for minorities, what happens next? According to Sowell, this inevitably leads to a rise in double standards in academia. Why does this happen? So that institutions can hide the negative effects of affirmative action policies. Sowell says this.
Part of the damage is concealed by double standards in grading. Many minority students are helped along academically by what David Reisman of Harvard has called affirmative grading, either because of the unwillingness of individual professors to flunk minority students, or because of the intervention of minority affairs officials on campus who ask that failing grades be reconsidered, or by the creation of courses and programs, various ethnic studies, for example, where minority students can expect to receive passing grades or better without undue effort.
A lot of people are aware that affirmative action policies enable minority students to get bumped up a tier or two or three or four in college admissions. I wonder if as many people are aware that affirmative action applies to faculty as well. Sowell says this.
As preferentially admitted minority students began to turn from academics to activism, including disruption and violence, among their recurring demands were more minority faculty and more relevant courses and programs. Both demands were widely met at colleges and universities across the country, as minority faculty, various racial and ethnic studies, and special minority cultural and social centers all became familiar parts of the academic landscape.
Sowell then points out that minority faculty suffer some of the same psychological effects as minority students who are mismatched with colleges. He says this.
Minority faculty hired preferentially face exactly the same problem of self-respect as the students admitted under double standards. It is fundamentally the same mismatching situation. A professor who would be a respected member of a department at an average college or university may be completely overshadowed in a department where colleagues are publishing regularly in the leading scholarly journals of the world, writing landmark books in their field, and receiving national and international recognition, honors, and prizes.
Affirmative action policies create not only double standards for performance in colleges and universities, they also create double standards for behavior, according to Sowell. Sowell gives many examples of how minority students are allowed behaviors which would never be tolerated of white students. Sowell says this.
Despite a readiness of university officials to interpret all sorts of words and deeds by whites as racist, even outright physical assaults by blacks against whites are unlikely to be labeled that way. When two white students at Brown University were victims of unprovoked street attacks by blacks, according to the student newspaper, the head of campus security was quick to point out that there is nothing at all that would tend to indicate that this is a racially motivated incident. After a similar unprovoked street attack on two white students by five blacks at the University of Wisconsin, Madison, the student newspaper there similarly reported that campus police do not believe the attack was racially motivated, although racial slurs were used. Indeed, when the students asked why they were being attacked, the answer was, "Because we're black and you're white." But officially, it was still not considered a racial attack.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
911, what's your emergency?
Hi, Lita!
I'm Kane Princeton.
Not Dr. Princeton. I am done with counseling. That's it.
This is a story about Mylena Hendrick, a corporate accountant at war with her enemies.
You are pathetic!
Depression.
Mylena, I love you.
And anxiety.
Connie, come back to me.
Mylena, everything will work out.
She needs a man.
I don't want to do this.
Sometimes the hardest thing about life is living life. Living life.
Listen to The Accountant and the Counselor wherever you get your podcast.
Sowell makes the argument that double standards for performance and behavior engender feelings of resentment among white students. Sowell quotes Dartmouth professor Jeffrey Hart.
The white student who gains admissions to a good college has undoubtedly worked hard for 4 years in secondary school and experienced the heavy anxiety of filing application for admission and waiting for acceptance or rejection. Such a student is very likely to be a competitive personality. That a black skin or a Hispanic surname is worth several hundred scholastic aptitude test points sticks in the craw. Even those who are themselves admitted often feel resentment on behalf of relatives or friends who were not admitted, despite better records than minority students admitted preferentially.
Sowell talks about many other side effects of preferential admissions policies for students and faculty. He discusses self-segregation by minority students, segregated campus events, as well as the rise of so-called diversity consultants on campus. About this latter phenomenon, he says this.
There is, in fact, a whole industry of diversity consultants or race relations specialists who give talks or conduct seminars on campus, advise administrators on racial matters, participate in freshman orientation programs, hold off-campus retreats for faculty members and administrators, prepare films, videotapes, or other materials, hold conferences around the country, and publish newsletters and magazines devoted solely to diversity. While individual styles vary, a common theme is that everyone white is racist, with the only distinction between those who are overt and those who do not realize their own racism, those who admit it and those who engage in psychological denial. To minority individuals, the message is, racism is pervasive around you, whether you realize it or not. Ambiguous situations should always be interpreted as racial affronts. Never think that you imagined it, one speaker at a Harvard workshop said, because chances are that you didn't.
I strongly encourage you to read Inside American Education in its entirety. I'll put a link in the show notes to Chapter 6 of the book. If you're interested in affirmative action policies and how they play out in academia, this chapter is an absolute must-read. Sowell ends Chapter 6 on a very somber note and with a warning to readers.
The obviously self-serving nature of the usual administrative responses to racial incidents, free speech restrictions, making ethnic studies courses mandatory, larger quotas for minority students and faculty, provide an impetus to new and ever-escalating rounds of double standards and racial backlash. Where will this self-reinforcing spiral end? In other countries, group preferences and quotas in higher education have led to widespread bloodshed, as in India, or to outright civil war, as in Sri Lanka. The growing evidences of racial hostility and sporadic outbreaks of violence, which we in the United States call the new racism, may be an early warning that we are heading in the same direction as other countries which have promoted preferences and quotas longer and more strongly. But the prevailing dogmatism among academics suggests that the real meaning of these early warnings may not be understood until long after it is too late.
To explore the subject of affirmative action in academia, I went to the campus of an elite Tier 1 university here in Los Angeles to talk with random students I chanced upon who were walking between buildings. I really like talking with everyday people and not just with the experts, because I like to see what regular people know about a subject and what they base their opinions on. You'll notice I don't argue with anyone and I don't try to convince anyone of anything. I simply ask some questions in order to find out what people believe, and I am a paragon of friendliness and politeness. After interviewing my sixth student, I suddenly noticed that four uniformed campus security guards had surrounded me. They spoke with me for a few minutes, then they kicked me off the campus. The great news is that my recorder was still on from the last interview, so you get to hear what the security guard said to me about why they were kicking me out. But the story gets even better. After I had left campus and was continuing my interviews on the public sidewalks along the periphery of the university, I noticed one of the security guards who had kicked me out was approaching me again, this time alone. He said to me, "I want to talk with you about something off the record." So I turned off my recorder and he and I proceeded to have a very interesting conversation for about 15 minutes. He apologized to me for kicking me out and told me that the only reason they had done that was because I was supporting conservative ideas. He said that if I had been giving out leaflets for Planned Parenthood, they would have left me alone. And that the campus was so left-leaning, he could barely take it anymore. He knew quite a bit about Thomas Sowell and asked me if he could still have a Sowell Post-it pad. I was so happy he asked that I gave him 3, which he said he would give out at his church next week. We enjoyed the talk so much that we exchanged phone numbers and agreed to meet for a beer soon and talk more about what had happened that day on campus and why. I'll keep you posted if we actually meet, and I'll ask him if I can record our conversation for a future episode of the podcast. Stay tuned for that. But first, let's hear my conversations with students at one of the most prestigious and well-known universities in the world, sharing their thoughts with me on the subject of affirmative action. Everyone who spoke with me received a free pad of Thomas Sowell quote post-it notes as a thank you for taking the time to talk with me. Right after the last interview, you hear me being approached by the security guards when I say, "Uh-oh, am I in trouble now?" Here are the interviews. I'm doing interviews for a podcast, and I was wondering if I could ask you a couple of quick questions.
Sure.
Okay, great. So the topic of today is affirmative action, preferential admissions policies. Do you know, how do you feel about that in general?
Useful. I mean, I think they go a long way in terms of, like, America has placed this expectation that, like, college is going to be the place where you kind of even out, you know, inequalities that have surfaced throughout the first, like, 12 years of education, which is really not the greatest place to do that. But if you're going to have college be the place where you're trying to make things more equal, because we're not placing a huge amount of investment in our public education system, then affirmative action is a good way of creating that stopgap.
Do you think there are any negative consequences of affirmative action?
No. Or, I mean, I don't know, there's going to be negative consequences of anything, but like...
Well, some people believe that students get mismatched with institutions when they get artificially placed in an institution where the other students perform academically much higher than they do.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
So how do you live a good life, especially now? Is it about happiness, purpose, love, or friendship? And what about health or wealth? Can you live a good life even if you're struggling? The truth is often not what you think. I'm Jonathan Fields, best-selling author and host of the award-winning Good Life Project podcast. Every week, we bring you revealing conversations with some of the smartest, most accomplished, and yes, sometimes famous people that will awaken insight, arm you with practical tips, and inspire you to live your best life no matter what comes your way. Look for Good Life Project on your favorite podcast app today.
That's definitely something that, like, everyone always brings up all the time. And I don't know, I would personally rather go to an institution that is diverse and has people that have had a lot of different experiences in life than one where, like, people are perhaps slightly more academically, you know, have a better academic background or whatever. I think that the latter option would be a lot more boring for me personally. So as a college student who's going to college, that's definitely my thought.
They don't really take, you know, race or the whole affirmative action stuff into account at all. Like, they tend to accept the people that are the best, and I think this is still a pretty very diverse environment. Like, obviously there's always work to be done. The admissions office is doing all it can to, you know, encourage a more diverse, at least undergraduates population. But I think what they're doing here is great, and I think that's having people of all different diverse, I keep saying the word diverse, viewpoints does not decrease the quality of the, you know, students we have here. In fact, I think it increases it. So
now, for the past few years, they've not been requiring SATs or ACT scores, right? So how do you think they're measuring people's academic ability?
Yeah, I'm in freshman here, so I was not required to submit my SAT scores. And
you did anyway or no?
I didn't.
Okay.
Yeah, so from my perspective, all of the people in my class are, you know, just as capable as, you know, any of the other upperclassmen that did have to submit their SAT scores. I work with the admissions office a little bit, so I think they, you know, it's the I guess the buzzword is like holistic application. So like they look at, you know, grades and the classes people took, what activities they are involved with in high school, basically to judge the person's character, because the SATs, you know, are just a number. That's what I was always told when I was applying. You know, the most important thing to get into college is, you know, doing the things with your life that you enjoy and show what you're good at. And, you know, the grades and numbers are just that. So
now, some people feel that affirmative action leads to a mismatch between students and institutions, so that students who get boosted or preferentially admitted don't have the academic skills that their peers at the school might have, and that could lead to early dropout. It could lead to feelings of insecurity, unworthiness, and it could cause a lot of emotional and social problems because of the mismatch. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I mean, certainly if, depending on how it's implemented, that I could imagine that happening. I don't think that is the case here, especially because the classes and the work here are just so hard to begin with that everyone is struggling almost to the same degree. So everyone is, you know, struggling together and, you know, helping each other out. And, you know, what some people are weaker at, other people are stronger at. So I think that, yeah, it does not cause any of those detrimental effects here.
Well, I think I'm also like one of the minorities. I don't know. I'm Turkish, so yeah, but yeah, like for my case, I don't really think like there is that kind of double standard. Like for my case, it was really hard to get in like a good school.
Actually, I don't have very, very solid opinion about it. I think it really depends on the sorts of groups you're trying to reach. And this is really case dependent on the sort of audience you're targeting, right? So what is the type of issues you're trying to address? Are those historical issues? Are those associated with underrepresented people? So it is really a rather complex question to answer. I would be definitely positive in these sorts of attitudes, but this has to be done with diligence, right?
Some people feel that students get mismatched with institutions. In other words, they get placed in institutions where their academic performance is much lower than the average student, and that can lead to feelings of insecurity. It could even lead to dropping out early.
I don't think that's only associated with admittance itself, but also on the programs and how they are conducted. I definitely understand this feeling. I think I have passed through it. I'm now at a point that I don't have this sort of feeling anymore because I tried to track this down. But yeah, it's certainly not just a mismatch, but also I think it's the whole context of a grad program, say, because we're graduate students, right? So I can only say for this programs, right?
I personally don't have much experience with the topic, but I've heard from teachers in inner city schools. I'm from Chicago, and she found that it was very helpful because a lot of times she didn't have the resources to get kids where they needed to be. So she was in favor of affirmative action, and I see that as a positive.
Affirmative action is sort of like a top-down solution.
which I don't think is the most effective way to solve the problem that it's trying to solve. I think looking at the root and the causes of things, and in general, I feel like education, if you fix the like educational disparities at the very base when people are still in school and educated, then you won't even need something like affirmative action that could be controversial to some people, like when it comes to college. So as long as everyone has like equal chances at like a decent good education, then like everyone would be at level ground once they go to college. So it might be like an optimistic take on things, but I think it would at least decrease the need for affirmative action, maybe. I don't know.
A lot of people go through that experience, like imposter syndrome, everyone has it to a certain degree. And so a really unfortunate thing that happens is like during the admissions process in high school, some people will be like, oh, a person only got into that school on the basis of their race. And I feel like that's not a fair claim to make. But I think that like once they show up there, I mean, it's not true for everybody, but I do think that like after a certain adjustment period, like it, you get used to it. And I think if you are able to, you will adapt to whatever, like, academic rigor there is.
I guess if it's true that, like, they're the top 10% of the country in their mathematical abilities, but they're still, like, the bottom 10% of the school, like, I feel like that's a bigger problem than just them, right? Like, I feel like there needs to be more support from the school in that aspect, or there needs to be some way to make up for that, because I think it correlates to the base reason why affirmative action even became a thing is because of the difference in education that people receive based on their identity, which I don't think should be true.
I think that affirmative action is a very nuanced subject, and people really try to boil it down to either for or against it. But like in its core, like affirmative action is trying to make like schools more equitable, and like diversity is really important, and they're trying to strive for that. It doesn't mean that like what we have now is perfect, but like it's trying to remedy a disparity that exists due to differences in socioeconomic status and background and that kind of thing.
I'm neutral to it. For me, I think I'm neutral. It doesn't usually work for me because I'm Asian, but I think it's good that like things are being done to break the cycle of like discrimination and like oppression for people of color and like historically disadvantaged groups. Personally, it doesn't work out good for me, I don't think, but I'm glad that things are being done.
Do you feel like it works against you?
Yes, I do feel like it works against me.
Now, some people object to affirmative action on the grounds that they feel that it mismatches students with institutions. So in other words, they be granted admission to a college or university that's just too hard for them, where all the other students perform much higher academically, and that mismatch can lead to depression, feeling of insecurity, inferiority, and maybe even dropping out. Have you ever thought about that?
No, because I feel like colleges would admit people who are equally as qualified, but maybe if they were looking at a white person and then a person of color who are both like on the same level, they would choose a person of color because they're like systematically oppressed. But I think maybe it could happen, but I'm not too sure. But that's what I think. I think that they would admit people who are like equally as good and qualified.
So you're feeling when all things are equal, they'll tend to take the person from the minority group, but they don't admit people below the general level is what you're thinking.
I think, but I don't really know what goes on in admission offices, so I'm not completely sure, but that's what I think.
Now, do you feel like affirmative action can lead to resentment from the groups that are disadvantaged because of it?
Yeah, possibly. Because usually, I think they're used to having priority or like not being discriminated against. So maybe they feel like that's hurting them, but because they don't really know what that feels like.
Am I in trouble?
Yes. It's a private campus.
Okay.
Just
walk through our campus, but okay. if you're interviewing people and taking pictures or doing anything of that sort, we do ask that you go through the proper measures.
I see.
We did receive a call that you were coming around asking students questions, interviewing them, and some students felt uncomfortable.
I see.
So we wanted to come and ask you to leave.
Okay,
We're just here for the safety of our students. Yeah. So.
Is it only because they were feeling uncomfortable that I'm being asked to leave, or is it...
Yes, and because it is private property and you are recording.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, that's fair enough.
Yeah.
I'll leave.
All right, thank
you. But then if I stop recording, can I stay?
Well, at this point today, since we've already been called for you,
okay.
we're going to ask you to leave for today.
Okay, but another day I can come back as long as I don't record?
If you're going through the proper measures, if you want to record things, you can always contact security through their through our supervisor email.
No problem.
And,
okay.
Okay. Make
now, can I position myself on the periphery of the college, on the public sidewalks?
If you're on the public sidewalks, then we can't stop you.
Okay.
But if we do get more phone calls about people saying they're uncomfortable, we will have to approach you and just let you know. But if you're on private or public
property then you're okay. Fair enough.
Can I ask what you're recording for?
Yes. Have you ever heard of Thomas Sowell?
Of course, yeah.
It's for a podcast called The Genius of Thomas Sowell. And those are post-it notes with 50 of his quotes.
Okay.
And it's a great podcast that talks about his ideas and his books. And we're doing an episode about affirmative action. You can keep it.
I don't.
No, you want it?
I know. I know Mr. Sol's stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you want to come back and do this sort of thing, like my colleague said, you need to go through the Office of Strategic Communications.
Okay.
They would give you whatever permissions you need to be here to do this officially. Anytime you're on private property and you want to conduct any sort of official enterprise, you really do need to go through the channels.
Okay. Fair enough. I don't want any trouble.
No, not
okay. Great, thank you.
All right, take care.
Okay, take care. Happy Easter.
Same to you.
So as you could hear, I was being asked to leave campus because someone had reported me for making them feel uncomfortable. I was probing this a little bit because I was trying to understand if I had really violated some rule of the campus by recording people or if I was being asked to leave because of the subject matter of my questions. I'll leave that question for you to decide for yourself. My general impression from the interviews is that none of these students had any real knowledge about the history and track record of affirmative action policies. I think it would be fair to say that much of what the students had to say was somewhat muddled and hard for me to wrap my head around. There seemed to be a general sense that affirmative action was somehow correcting societal wrongs, but it wasn't clear to anyone that it was working as intended. By the way, I did talk with one person who was firmly against affirmative action policies, but I didn't include that clip because the audio quality was poor. I just wanted you to know that there was some dissenting opinion. While researching for this episode, I came across a few great clips on the internet, which are worth exploring here. The first clip is from Sowell's 2011 book, The Thomas Sowell Reader.
Years ago, when I was running a research project in Washington, a memorandum came down from on high, telling us that there was money available to hire minority professionals for the summer, without having to take it out of the regular project budget. Wonderful, I said. There's a Jewish lady up at Princeton who wants to come down here and help me out, but I don't have any money to pay her. This idea was shot down immediately. Jews are not a minority, I was told, and Jews from Princeton are definitely not a minority. It did no good to point out that Jews are only 3% of the population, and so must be a minority. Nor did it do any good to say that Jews were defined as an ethnic minority in the research project itself. The powers that be turned a deaf ear to all such arguments. In a sense, they were right. The word minority had already become one of the many politically corrupted words. It no longer meant a statistically smaller part of the population. It meant people you feel sorry for. After all their achievements, nobody felt sorry for Jews anymore. Therefore, they were not a minority. Nobody feels sorry for Asian Americans anymore, after so many success stories. Therefore, they are increasingly excluded from minority status in programs and policies at some colleges and universities.
This is one of those clips which once you hear, you can never forget. It gets at the way language becomes distorted over time in order to manipulate thinking. It's what George Orwell spent his entire career warning us about. The next clip is from a 1995 television interview. Sowell talks about the way affirmative action policies delegitimize the real accomplishments of minorities. Here's the clip.
As this argument has been, I'm sure, voiced to you before. Mm. Clarence Thomas benefited from affirmative action.
Who said so?
Clarence Thomas says so, I bet.
No.
He doesn't.
No, he does not.
Clarence Thomas does not say that affirmative action programs helped him in terms of the educational opportunities he
received. No, he's never said it to me.
Do you think he would say no to that question?
He might well, for one thing. My understanding, and I haven't researched it, my understanding is that he was admitted to college the year before they began their affirmative action program.
I don't know his
answer. And what the program did was to delegitimize what he had done.
Yeah.
He was a man with an outstanding academic record.
Right.
And he goes out into the job market
they look at him and they say, you got there only because of affirmative action rather than because of your own merit.
Ordinarily, someone with that kind of record, you'd look at it and say, hey, this guy is really a world beater.
He's hot, yeah.
But I've seen that in my own life. I'm old enough that I've gone through the whole metamorphosis.
And what have you seen in your own life?
All right. When I was in the Marine Corps and during the Korean War, I was trained as a photographer, and I was assigned to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, where a great many of Southerners were in the Marine Corps, white Southerners. And in that barracks, whenever somebody had a photographic problem, his camera wasn't working, his pictures didn't come out right, and so forth, they would come to me. I was astonished. The most biggest redneck in the barracks would come to me to ask me, and there were all these white photographers.
Fix my camera.
Yeah. You see, why is this? And I finally figured it out. They said, you know, if this guy is black and he's a photographer, he must be some photographer, you know. Now, when I started teaching in the early 1960s at the Douglas College, yeah. I read up on all the stuff about new teachers, you see, and how it's hard to get the respect of the students, particularly if you're not much older than they are, and I looked younger than I was. And so I worried about that, you see, and I walked in that room the first day, and there was instant respect. And it sort of took me aback. And I realized, they're saying, look, this guy, I was the first black male to teach there. This guy must be something else, you know. Go forward now 10 years. By this time, I've completed my degree. I've written my books, journal articles, all the whole thing. I'm now teaching at UCLA. And students will come up to me at the end of the term. They'll say how much they like the course and all that. And somewhere in the course of that, there'll be a slip up and they'll let it out that they were quite surprised that the course was as good as it was. And one of the things that struck me even before the end of the term, one kid came to me one day and he had a passage in the book he was having trouble with. Yeah. And he said, can you tell me what this means? I explained to him what that passage meant. He said, are you sure? And I said, yes, I wrote the textbook. And he looked in the front, he's really embarrassed. You know? But this is what affirmative action has done, you see.
This clip makes me think of the recent appointment of Ketanji Brown Jackson to the U.S. Supreme Court. President Biden announced in advance that he was only going to nominate a female African-American to the court, and he kept that promise. Based on what Sowell said in this clip, I imagine that he would view this as another example of affirmative action delegitimizing the very real accomplishments of black scholars. The next clip is from a 1990 C-SPAN interview with Sowell about his book, Preferential Policies, an International Perspective.
At the University of California at Berkeley, for example, where the entering freshman class has been described as, quote, wonderfully diverse, unquote, mm-hmm. because the, quote, class closely reflects the actual ethnic distribution of California high school students. These are your words. More than 70% of black students fail to graduate.
Yes.
Why?
Because they're mismatched with Berkeley. That is, the average black student at Berkeley is above the national average on test scores. It's just that the average white student is further above the national average, and the average Asian student further above than the white students. And so in that atmosphere, these students who have every qualification to succeed are artificially turned into failures. And the only beneficiary of that is the University of California at Berkeley. Because what they've effectively done is rented these bodies for window dressing for a few years. And then when they're through with them, they're put aside. A new bunch of bodies are brought in.
In this clip, Sowell explains why mismatching leads to lower graduation rates and that university administrators don't really care, as long as they can paint a picture of their campus as being wonderfully diverse. Here's another clip from that same C-SPAN interview.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Adam Pacifico, host of the UK's number one ranked leadership podcast, The Leadership Enigma. We're helping leaders, their teams and organizations all over the world discover new ways of working to succeed in a world that just won't stop changing. With over 100 episodes already, our guests have included top CEOs, Olympic athletes, undercover police officers, former NBA players, psychologists, New York Times best-selling authors, military commanders, academics, and more. We'd love you to come and join the conversation and be part of the Leadership Enigma community.
All right, let's take it from the standpoint of the school. You're at the school and you want to do good.
Mm.
You say it doesn't work. What would you tell the school to do?
To admit students on the basis of their qualifications.
But what happens if they come up and statistically they have nothing close to the population?
Well, they won't. They won't have anything at the top level. But we have more than 3,000 colleges and universities in this country. Every human being that's not severely mentally retarded is perfectly qualified to be at one of those institutions. I mean, there are institutions where if you can fill out the application form, you're qualified to do the work. And there are others where if you're not in the top 1 or 2%, your chances of making it are extremely slim. And it's precisely these second places that they want to send black students that they don't send white students of the same level of ability. And it's not at all surprising that they had to run into the academic problems they do. Let me give you another example that's not in the book. At MIT, the average black student is at the top 10% nationwide in mathematics and in the bottom 10% at MIT. And 1/4 of them don't make it. Now, when you realize how few black students at that level, to lose 1/4 of them, you can't afford that. I think there's another larger loss that you have. You have the kid who goes to a top-level school, and he wants to be a chemist or whatever. And now he gets there and he finds he cannot learn chemistry as it's taught at that school. It does not mean he can't learn chemistry. It means that they have very high-pressure students. They can teach this stuff at a very fast rate, skipping on explanations, skipping over steps in the mathematics, and these students will all pick that up as they go along. He may find that he can't keep up with that. And so in order to survive, he switches into some easy subject, which may be some ethnic studies program or what have you. And so someone who could have gotten a first-rate education at a good college ends up getting a third-rate education at a top college, or ends up flunking out altogether.
Sowell packs a lot into this one monologue. He explains better than I could how there is a tier system in America's colleges and how affirmative action is particularly insidious at the top tier schools. He gives the MIT example I talked about in my summary. He then explains how affirmative action policies will cause many students to leave their original course of study and pursue easier majors, which is a loss to both a student and to society as a whole. The next clip is from a conversation between Sowell and Peter Robinson from the Hoover Institution about affirmative action in India. What's fascinating about this discussion is that most Americans incorrectly assume that affirmative action is a uniquely American phenomenon. I wish I had asked the students I interviewed earlier in this episode if they knew that other countries around the world practice affirmative action as well. But I'll bet that not a single person would have known about this. I certainly didn't know this until I started reading Sowell. Here's the clip.
Let's look at some of the data. India, once again, from affirmative action around the world. Quote, India has had affirmative action programs longer than any other nation, beginning in the British colonial times and then provided for in its constitution when it became an independent country in 1947, close quote. Take us through this. In India, affirmative action is for whom?
Initially, it was for the untouchables, who are probably among the most persecuted people on earth. At a time when blacks in the South had to sit in the back of the bus, untouchables weren't supposed to sit anywhere. They were to stand in the back of the bus. Mm-hmm. You know, and then it just goes on from there.
This is what percentage of the population?
About, if I remember correctly, about 16%.
16%. And these are people who are so low they don't even count in the caste system.
No, that's right. That's right. Treated abominably. And so it's understandable people would want to do something to make things better for them. What actually happened, however, is that extremely few untouchables actually are able to make use of any of these preferences and quotas.
The preferences and quotas are for hiring or education, or what form do they take?
They're actually for hiring, for education, for seats in parliament. But of course, for all those things, you have to have various complementary resources. So it doesn't do you any good if you're somebody out in a little village where you're struggling to make ends meet, that there's a place reserved for you in the medical school. You'll be lucky if you can make it to high school.
Is that a case of affirmative action badly aimed? Meaning, should there be more economic resources? Should that be the kind of affirmative action? Should they be targeting Milton Friedman's old idea of a negative income tax? Should they just be putting cash in the hands of untouchables?
That wouldn't be affirmative action, I guess. Well, affirmative action really is preferences and quotas. But the things for which they create preferences and quotas, not only in India but in other countries around the world, are typically things that the elite would be interested in. College admission, government jobs, seats in parliament. And for that, you have to have other resources. So what we call untouchables, as if they're one sort of uniform group, is really a collection of many different groups, many of whom are separate from each other and do not intermarry or whatnot. And the ones of the untouchables, there are some who are prosperous for one historical reason or another. And they grab off the lion's share of all these benefits. Mm. And the vast majority of untouchables are completely cut off from these things.
In this next clip from the same interview, Sowell reveals a fascinating aspect of affirmative action, which I think Sowell doesn't talk about enough in Inside American Education, namely, how preferential policies lead to high levels of resentment among the people who are disadvantaged by the policies. And he explains why the levels of resentment are out of all proportion to the actual affirmative action practiced. This is really interesting.
Let me quote you again. This is from your conclusion about India. It is hard to escape the conclusion that affirmative action in India has produced minimal benefits to those most in need and maximum resentments and hostility toward them on the part of others.
Yes.
Now, that's the second piece of this. Why should it be that affirmative action should increase the resentment toward untouchables?
Because if there are 100 jobs there, and three of them have been set aside for and three untouchables are actually able to make use of the set asides for them, then everybody who lost the job will say he would have been hired if it only been the untouchables hadn't grabbed these. Mm. Now there may be 50 people seething with anger at not having gotten these three jobs. But had there been no untouchables, 47 of them wouldn't have gotten the jobs anyway.
I see.
And so you create a resentment out of all proportion to the actual benefits that have been transferred.
I want to switch gears a little bit with this next clip. It's from a recent podcast discussion between Glenn Lowry and Sam Harris about affirmative action. What I find most interesting about the over 1 hour long discussion between these two brilliant scholars is that the concept of the mismatching effect never gets mentioned. Instead, they frame the affirmative action debate in a different way.
Yeah, I honestly don't know what I believe about affirmative action. I mean, I think, you know, the first approximation, I think, at one point, it was absolutely necessary, and it was obviously a lever that could be pulled to right a moral wrong and a social ill. But I think now we're at a point where it's creating its own negative effects, such that, I mean, to name only one, it requires obvious racism against Asians at this moment to be enacted. So I don't know. I don't know what I think. I think it's problematic for a lot of reasons, some of which you just cited, based on what Amy said. I mean, I think the most insidious aspect to it is that I can envision occasions where it would seem to justify something that looks like racism, you know, even though it would be motivated differently. I'm thinking of a case where, I mean, for instance, if it could be established, I believe it might have been established that the medical field, you know, various medical fields have practiced such affirmative action that you could reliably expect that the people in those jobs, you know, the cardiologists or the brain surgeons of color had less stringent requirements applied to them to get into those positions, right? If that is in fact true, I mean, I know people like Charles Murray have argued that it is true. You know, you get one chance to have brain surgery, you know, on yourself or on your kid, right? And so how enthusiastic should you be to have a Black brain surgeon if you know that, you know, the MCATs for Black doctors are a standard deviation lower or whatever it is, right? I mean, I know Charles Murray has delved rather deeply and dangerously into the facts of that kind in his latest book. If in fact that were true, and you would expect it to be true if affirmative action really has been widely practiced there, that's a really insidious and perverse outcome. The last thing I would want would be to be confronted with the choice between two surgeons for a very, very potentially life-saving and a life-jeopardizing surgery, and to have my main criteria be in deciding between them the color of their skin. I mean, that's not the world I want to live in, and that's potentially a world we have engineered through good intentions, right? And so that's something that. That's one example. I mean, there are many examples where, you know, the stakes aren't that high and we don't care. And it's in fact rational to care about the social good of diversity, say, but, you know, brain surgery is not one of them. Right. And, you know, as is, you know,
it's a powerful example,
you know, and pervert, analogously, you know, but on the other side of the coin, athletics is not one of them. You know, I don't see anyone arguing that we need more Jews in the 100-meter dash at the Olympics. Right. And there are no Jews alleging anti-Semitism for the fact that Jews are not well represented, you know, on the podium at the Olympics.
Yeah.
Sam's main concern about affirmative action is that it will undermine our confidence in meritocracy and will lead to the mistrust of credentialed experts. I get that, and that's important for sure. But what neither of them mentioned during their discussion is one of Sowell's key points, that affirmative action is not helping and is in fact actually harming the people it is intended to help. The next clip is from another Glenn Lowry podcast where he interviews University of Pennsylvania Law School professor Amy Wax in 2018. If you're not familiar with the brilliant and fearless Amy Wax, I caution you in advance not to operate any heavy machinery while listening to this clip.
I got to ask you this. Because you've been accused of thinking that the African-American students at Penn and presumably elsewhere are not up to it. Do you think they're inferior?
Well, the word inferior is so loaded. Let me answer this question. Do I think that their efforts are expended in the right direction? Do I think that they are doing everything that is necessary to be the best they can be? I would have to say no to that, based on my experience again, Glenn, my observations. Inferior is a word that it's so nonspecific. I don't think they're inferior.
Do you think that they are not capable of measuring up at a competitive place like Penn?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello. Welcome to the Redfern Book Review Podcast. I am your host, Amy Mayer, and if you're a reader, I think my show might just be for you. What I do is I take a deep dive into the books you've been wanting to read, other books you've never heard of, and we talk about all things literary. Think public radio meets your book club via your best friend. We talk to authors, my friends, and I just add personal musings. It's a lot of fun.
I would say they are capable because the students at Penn, not Glenn, not everybody can be in the top 20%. Okay. So that's definitional. All right. People who come to Penn represent a range of abilities, and I don't have prior knowledge of the, but I will tell you this, Glenn, I have to say this. All right. There is affirmative action. What does affirmative action mean? It means that people are admitted under such programs under different quantitative standards. It's whether you like it or not, that is true. So just take the LSAT. People want to bury these facts. They really want to bury them. I understand it. The average LSAT of Blacks overall, because these data are available, is less than the average LSAT of whites and Asians. Someone told me today, and I haven't verified it, that there are no students in year X, very recently, Black students who scored over 171 on the LSAT, whereas there are, I think, hundreds, even thousands of Black and, I mean, excuse me, white and Asian students who have, you know, people have been deluging me with data and with statistics. But these are well-known facts. And the LSAT is predictive. We don't like that. It's an inconvenient fact, but it is. So we can deny reality. We can bury reality. We can ignore reality. Maybe we can get away with it. Now, here's the other thing. Let's ignore this stuff. Who cares about this stuff? Who cares about what grades people get? Why do we fetishize it? Why don't we even notice it? Well, we notice it because once people get out in the real world, these measures have consequences. They have consequences, whether we like it or not, and imperfectly, very much imperfectly, in predicting how people perform in the tasks that they are required to perform in their professional lives, in their work lives.
Again, what I find most interesting about the way Professor Wax talks about these issues is that she does so without ever alluding to or mentioning the mismatching effect. I really have to wonder if she's just not that familiar with the concept or if she just doesn't lend it much credence. Because to me, the mismatching effect is the best way to explain her experience at Penn Law that Black students there, admitted under affirmative action, are clustered in the bottom third of her classes in terms of blind grading. This last clip is very short, just a few seconds. It's from a 1984 conversation with Tony Brown. It will make you laugh, and it will also make you marvel at Sowell's ability to cause a paradigm shift in the thinking of those who listen to him speak. Watch the magic unfold in real time before your very ears.
So it depends on what you're holding as your standard.
The standard is that Blacks haven't caught up with whites.
But whites haven't stood still.
I'd like to end this episode with a personal story, a poem, and a song. When I was in high school back in the 1970s, I fell in love with a Canadian rock band called Rush. Most of you listening will probably not know about this band. They are somewhat esoteric. One of my favorite Rush albums was called 2112, and on the inside jacket of the album, the band wrote, quote, "dedicated to the genius of Ayn Rand," end quote. Who is Ayn Rand, I wondered. The next day, I did some research in the school library and discovered a book written by Ayn Rand called The Fountainhead, which I promptly borrowed and read. I distinctly remember sitting on my childhood bed, and after reading only 5 pages of The Fountainhead, I looked up from the pages and said out loud, "This is the best book I have ever read." From that moment on, I have been hooked on ideas and how important they are in shaping history. This passion for ideas led me to major in intellectual history in college. After college, I never stopped reading and learning. For me, college was not the end of my education, but only the beginning. One day, many years later, while standing in a Barnes & Noble bookstore in Manhattan, I chanced upon a Thomas Sowell book called Economic Facts and Fallacies. I had never heard of Sowell before, but I bought the book and took it home. As you've probably noticed, I've been hooked on Sowell ever since. Isn't it interesting how a rock album discovered in one's youth can lead to a college major, which can lead to an intellectual podcast decades later? It's funny how the dots of one's life get connected and can only be understood looking backward, never forward. Steve Jobs shared this insight with us at a 2005 commencement address he gave at Stanford University. If you've never heard this address, you're in for a real treat. Here it is.
Thank you. I'm honored to be with you today for your commencement from one of the finest universities in the world. Truth be told, I never graduated from college, and this is the closest I've ever gotten to a college graduation. Today, I want to tell you 3 stories from my life. That's it. No big deal. Just 3 stories. The first story is about connecting the dots. I dropped out of Reed College after the first 6 months, but then stayed around as a drop-in for another 18 months or so before I really quit. So why'd I drop out? It started before I was born. My biological mother was a young, unwed graduate student, and she decided to put me up for adoption. She felt very strongly that I should be adopted by college graduates, so everything was all set for me to be adopted at birth by a lawyer and his wife. Except that when I popped out, they decided at the last minute that they really wanted a girl. So my parents, who were on a waiting list, got a call in the middle of the night asking, "We've got an unexpected baby boy. Do you want him?" They said, "Of course." My biological mother found out later that my mother had never graduated from college and that my father had never graduated from high school. She refused to sign the final adoption papers. She only relented a few months later when my parents promised that I would go to college. This was the start in my life. And 17 years later, I did go to college. But I naively chose a college that was almost as expensive as Stanford. And all of my working class parents' savings were being spent on my college tuition. After 6 months, I couldn't see the value in it. I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life and no idea how college was going to help me figure it out. And here I was, spending all of the money my parents had saved their entire life. So I decided to drop out and trust that it would all work out okay. It was pretty scary at the time, but looking back, it was one of the best decisions I ever made. The minute I dropped out, I could stop taking the required classes that didn't interest me and begin dropping in on the ones that looked far more interesting. It wasn't all romantic. I didn't have a dorm room, so I slept on the floor in friends' rooms. I returned Coke bottles for the 5-cent deposits to buy food with. And I would walk the 7 miles across town every Sunday night to get one good meal a week at the Hare Krishna temple. I loved it. And much of what I stumbled into by following my curiosity and intuition turned out to be priceless later on. Let me give you one example. Reed College at that time offered perhaps the best calligraphy instruction in the country. Throughout the campus, every poster, every label on every drawer was beautifully hand calligraphed. Because I had dropped out and didn't have to take the normal classes, I decided to take a calligraphy class to learn how to do this. I learned about serif and sans serif typefaces, about varying the amount of space between different letter combinations, about what makes great typography great. It was beautiful, historical, artistically subtle in a way that science can't capture, and I found it fascinating. None of this had even a hope of any practical application in my life. But 10 years later, when we were designing the first Macintosh computer, it all came back to me. And we designed it all into the Mac. It was the first computer with beautiful typography. If I had never dropped in on that single course in college, the Mac would have never had multiple typefaces or proportionally spaced fonts. And since Windows just copied the Mac, it's likely that no personal computer would have them. If I had never dropped out, I would have never dropped in on that calligraphy class, and personal computers might not have the wonderful typography that they do. Of course, it was impossible to connect the dots looking forward when I was in college, but it was very, very clear looking backwards 10 years later. Again, you can't connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking backwards. So you have to trust that the dots will somehow connect in your future. You have to trust in something, your gut, destiny, life, karma, whatever. Because believing that the dots will connect down the road will give you the confidence to follow your heart, even when it leads you off the well-worn path. And that will make all the difference.
When you understand Steve Jobs' insight about connecting life's dots, you will understand why I created the Thomas Sowell Post-it notepads. Each pad has 50 different Sowell quotes beautifully illustrated. When I place one of the notes in an unexpected place, you never know who will come upon that note, read it, and wonder, who is Thomas Sowell? Just like I wondered, who is Ayn Rand over 40 years ago? If that person takes the next step and looks up Sowell on YouTube or reads one of his books, that person's intellectual life might be changed forever. So one post-it note discovered by serendipity can literally change someone's life. If you, like me, believe that the world would be a better place if more people read Thomas Sowell, I encourage you to purchase as many post-it note pads as you can afford and place the notes wherever people might see them. There's info in the show notes about how to buy them. So I'd like to end this episode about affirmative action with a poem in the form of a song, written by my longtime favorite rock band, Rush, back in 1978. I'm not going to play the whole song, just the beginning so you get the flavor. Then I'll read the lyrics, which are short and to the point. I'm not going to comment on the lyrics or try to explain them in any way. I will leave each of you alone with your own interpretation. The song is called The Trees, and I'll put a link in the show notes to the full song on YouTube.
There is unrest in the forest, there is trouble with the trees, for the maples want more sunlight and the oaks ignore their pleas.
There is unrest in the forest, there is trouble with the trees, for the maples want more sunlight, and the oaks ignore their pleas. The trouble with the maples, and they're quite convinced they're right. They say the oaks are just too lofty, and they grab up all the light. But the oaks can't help their feelings if they like the way they're made, and they wonder why the maples can't be happy in their shade. There is trouble in the forest, and the creatures all have fled, as the maples scream oppression, and the oaks just shake their heads. So the maples formed a union and demanded equal rights. The oaks are just too greedy. We will make them give us light. Now there's no more oak oppression, for they passed a noble law, and the trees are all kept equal by hatchet, axe, and saw. I'm Alan Wolin, and this has been episode 18 of the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast. Join us for episode 19, where we will host a debate between two scholars about Sowell's views on affirmative action. Thanks for listening.